My name is John Schramm, and this is the final in a series of Bible studies on Philippians with the subtitle, Can We Enjoy the Feast in an Ordinary Congregation? The further title today is In Process. We have to choose the titles last Saturday. Well, I didn't know where we would be by this Saturday, so I gave it this very exciting title, Magnanimity, and let's see, what was the contentment? Well, that isn't really what we're doing today. So I'm going to go with a tentative title up here, and we'll see if it helps or works. You have to put something on the tape. How about Eucharistic Living? We're going to test that out today. That's the first announcement I need to make. Second one, I violated my own principles yesterday. I promised you on Monday that about half the time would be yours and half the time would be mine, and I exceeded that yesterday. Secondly, as I thought back over the session, I think I also violated my principle, and that is that you could get God's word addressing you from Philippians, and instead of that, I thought Paul really didn't do an adequate job of explaining the theology of the cross, that I had to do it for you, which was probably unnecessary. So, if you can take my advice again, don't worry about the tape and what I said. Go back to Philippians sometime, especially Philippians 2, 5 to 11, and let that be part of a liturgical hymn that you get into your very soul and heart so that you have a good theological base. Those are my two introductions today. What we're going to do is read through Philippians again. When you read it through this time, keep in mind, what would the marks of Eucharistic living be? That's going to be what you're looking for as you read through it. I don't think I'm going to give you more definition of Eucharistic. Obviously, we mean more than just celebrating the Eucharist in a congregation. But what would, that's the symbol of a way of life. But what you're looking for really is the marks of, could our parish be described as, that's a place where they live Eucharistically. Okay. The only introduction I'm going to give before you read Philippians is a poem from Gerhard Frost. No surprise to you, it has to do with his two children. Little sisters, 4 and 6, today the mail brought what they liked and looked for, a catalog, replete with many colored pictures. The first to page it was the 6-year-old, and she turned each page possessively, saying wherever she found what pleased her, I want this, I want that, I want this. The litany of selfishness ended, and came the moment of the 4-year-old. She, who did not yet know the why of catalogs, turned pages, pointing to, but the words were new. We got that. We got this. We got that. I want, we have. What a difference it would make in this our global village if 4-year-old love and wisdom ruled the day. Please read through Philippians again, looking for the marks of Eucharistic living. Okay, if you would visit with two other people, and I think it's helpful if you just keep your Bible open, and when you share, I think this is a mark of Eucharistic living or something, you point to the place in Philippians, but do it however you want to. If you haven't met the person when you turn your chair, please introduce yourself, but just spend a couple minutes on the marks you find about Eucharistic living. Now we find out whether or not it was a helpful title, because the only reason for the title is not that you can tell one tape from the other, but did it help you as you read Philippians to get a different slant, to have some other things come out for you? Is it a helpful kind of summary to our week together? So now my choice is on trial, and you are the ones who will decide by whether or not you had a good reading and a good discussion. You're nodding your head. That's encouraging. I mean, this way, not this way. Okay. What did you find as a mark of Eucharistic living as you...
If found two that were missed out. One was in the first chapter, verses 3-5.
Okay, you want to share a summary of that in your own words, or read that, or?
Sure. It's just giving thanks for, thanking God for all of them.
Okay. That's what Eucharist means, is Thanksgiving meal. So if you found in Philippians an attitude of thanksgiving or thankfulness, that would be one of the ways we express Eucharistic living. What's the other one you found?
Chapter 4, verses 4-9.
That starts, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Let your, so joy or cheerfulness or, there's even one part that says stop complaining. Eucharistic living is when you have one member of the community who on occasion says, shut up and adjust. Maybe you can't do that in your community. But Karin Erlander used to do that. You know gentle Karin Erlander, Dan's wife? She was great at that in the winter community. Shut up and adjust. let's stick with 4-5, though. When we have one, and I think it's a way to move into Philippians, that's the way we'll do it today. Our agenda is just to continue to find marks and share it. And if there's a portion of Philippians that maybe we ought to expand a little bit more, would you read 4-5 in yours?
Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice.
That's all right.
Let all people know your forbearance.
Thank you.
The Lord is at hand.
Let all people know your forbearance. The Lord is at hand. I need another translation.
Let your gentle attitude toward everyone.
Let your gentle attitude.
Show a gentle attitude.
Show a gentle attitude. And Nikki?
Let your gentleness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand.
Forbearance, gentle attitude, gentleness. Got another one, Linda?
Moderation. No, that was it. Moderation.
Let your moderation be known.
Mine says, let your
magnanimity
be manifest to all.
Now you know where I got the word last Saturday, and now you know why we didn't use it. You can't pronounce it, and the tape ministry didn't have room to type it. Magnanimity. Forbearance, gentleness, gentle attitude, moderation, magnanimity. Goodness sakes, what is the Greek word? What's going on? Aren't those different in your at least common understanding of that word? Yeah. Which one touches you the most, or is most provocative? Meaning, I gotta live with that a little bit of those translations that you heard.
Gentleness,
like that, magnanimity.
I like the magnanimity, even though I have a hard time pronouncing it. It implies gentleness and generosity and a bigness and an openness.
Right.
That is moving out towards.
Yep. Yep. That's the dictionary definition. Yep.
Abundance.
Okay. All right. On the scale of I like, I like and don't like, way over on don't like is moderation.
Yeah.
Moderate. Do we need more encouragement? Moderation. Whew. If I tell Mary I'm excited, she believes me because she loves me and trusts me, but it doesn't show. We don't need to be told to be more moderate. We ought to be more excited or something. But anyway, the reason for all those different translations is I told you before that we picked Philippians partly because there are not many serious contextual problems, and you don't need all kinds of commentaries and a Greek scholar to help you read the letter. We've proved that over and over again this week. I've been delighted with your moving into the letter. This Greek word is very hard to find one English word that fits it. And sometimes I think it would do us a service if they would take the time that it takes to give an English picture for what the Greek word said. I found that when Mary and I went to Africa and they were translating into the local dialect in a particular country, it was very hard for the Bible translators to have literal translations. They just didn't work. Well, epiakes, I think is the Greek word. I think the most helpful picture is this. Let your fitting in to the way things are and your share of what there is. Let your moving into the reality of that and taking your place in there, let your fitting in be evident to everybody. What if the testimony of the Christian church in the world today was we were the ones who made it very clear to everybody we knew how to fit in regard like to the created world and the other animals, plants, and trees that share this with us, or what about in the whole global family? We were the ones who didn't take more than our share. We fit in. How would we do in the United States, 5.6% of the population using about 40% of the stuff to live the way we live? Not a very good let your, whatever this word is, fitting in, be evident to all. But that's what Paul is really saying. That would be Eucharistic living. The Eucharist was not a Eucharistic meal. If some ate so much they got drunk in Corinth and other people didn't have enough to eat, that's not a Eucharistic meal. The Eucharistic meal is this shared meal. It's the manna from heaven, and if you need more, take more, and if you need less, take less. The only ones who were really in trouble were those who took more than they needed. It rotted and the stink rose to heaven. That's what you smell. Trying to take more than we need, and it rotted. So this kind of fitting in is a very beautiful word about the Eucharistic meal. Okay, we've got two. Thanks, joy. Thanks, good start, thank you. Other Eucharistic living, what would it be like?
Generosity came out.
Generosity.
Real clear, particularly in that same passage 4 through 9, or maybe on down through 13, because out of God's generosity to us comes this marvelous peace, and yet peaceful living is not something one keeps to oneself, but verses 8 through 13 really push one to live generously.
Uh-huh.
Out of that generosity.
Great. Other people want to comment on generosity? You keep thinking of your church back home. Would that be a description? We're a generous people? Some of you are nodding. Great, great. That'd be a fine mark. Let me share something with you, and I will give, I'll give a important note at the end. So I'm not using it as pointing the finger. I'm using it as illustrative. Hartford, Connecticut is a city in bad decline. I don't know the last time you were in Hartford, Connecticut. It's not in real good shape. The Roman Catholic Archbishop there is Daniel Cronin. There was a situation in Hartford that made the newspaper because there were some Roman Catholic sisters who had a soup kitchen, and Hartford is in enough decline that they were just overwhelmed with the number of people who needed to eat every day. And they ran out of space in this little soup kitchen. So they asked for space in a very large downtown church, whether it was the cathedral for the archdiocese or not, I don't know. But it was in a perfect location, and they had all kinds of space and a well-equipped kitchen. They were turned down. And the reason they were turned down was the archdiocese feared that poor people lined up on the sidewalk would harm downtown development, would give the parish a bad image downtown. And this is the official archdiocese press release. Quote, "The church has to be primarily concerned with the well-being of the parish. We have to be concerned about its function and the image that it projects to people who come there. If they don't like the image, they won't come. It's a question of survivability." I read that not to point to this bishop, to whoever his press release person is, or to the Roman Catholic Church. I read that because they were much more honest than most of our churches in saying it's a matter of survivability. They simply put it out there. It's still tragic, don't misunderstand me, but I'm not using them and pointing to them. I'm using them to say, ooh, that's it for us, isn't it? And that's not Eucharistic living. Not using. Is this a dilemma at your church? Survivability and mission? It obviously is not real simple. I'm not trying to make it real simple. I'm trying to make it a thing that we ought to be wrestling with more. But How do you do when you think in terms your own parish, your own life, survivability and generosity? How do you fly? That's what our saviors at 24th in Chicago in Minneapolis did when they had a little bit of money. They spent it on the doors all around the church. It's a shelter. It's among people. It's but they wanted to. Great. Other things. Is there another mark? What we're going to do when we get the marks is then go back to the one that appeals to you the most or you have some questions about, and that's where our discussion will be. So we're not going to just end with a list, but I want to get the list out there before we concentrate on any one of them more. Nikki.
Community. And I see that in the Paul is sending his friend, his brother, and co-worker to keep the connection.
Yep. Okay. Other people have that one? Yes.
Well, that was close. The word was unity.
Unity. Common unity. Community. Okay. What I hope is that what this last slant will do is have us see the connections between the whole week. That's what we started with. Common unity or community that Paul assumes when he writes. The diversity is great only after you really can count on some of that common unity as to why you're there and who you are and what have you. And that comes back then in the expression of the Eucharistic living. You could say that the thanks and the joy are very closely connected with the letter begins and ends with grace. And the whole theme of what grace means is we ought to be able to lighten up and be more thankful and have some people who help us understand that thankfulness. How about the grandmother who prayed, "Oh, dear God, thank you that the two teeth I have left meet." Ruth.
I don't know if I can give you a specific verse on this. So.
Good. That could also be connected if you could go through and see, is it possible in our life to begin to expand the things for which we can be thankful?
Right.
And that's connected with just how all-pervasive is grace, meaning the more things that you can sense as gift, then the more your life is graced, and the more you will be able to be thankful. The more things that are gift and not, I earned them, I deserve them, they're mine, and they're my possessions, the thankfulness is not as spontaneous. And finally, I think you could say, all is gift. And what we do is keep moving into seeing more, even my own life, then the Eucharistic living becomes much more spontaneous, right? So they really are connected. Thank you, Ruth. I don't know that I picked up all you said, but it'll remind us of it. Yeah.
Well, I like the passage on 21:3, where Paul talks about transformation and about the community being in a process of transformation.
Okay.
Into Christ-like transformation. So it seems to me the Eucharistic community anticipates that kind of change itself as well.
Mm-hmm. 3:21 and following. Thank you, Don. You want to add? Yeah, Jim.
For lack of a better word, repetition. In 3:1 he says, "Rejoice in the Lord. To write the same thing to you is not irksome to me." It's over and over again. It's not anything new. It's just continual. Repeating of the experience.
Kind of rhythm. I don't even know how to spell it.
R-H-Y-T-H-M.
Okay. At some point, we can also connect these with what we more specifically call the Eucharist, which is supposed to not only symbolize Eucharistic living and be the time of thanksgiving and the meal, but also where we experience. We are what we eat. Where it not only symbolizes it, but it builds it. And the repetition of that, I walked in a monastery in Three Rivers, Michigan, Anglican Benedictines, beautiful place and delightful people. And they were commenting on what the liturgy meant, and he said, well, Benedictines interrupt their life seven times a day so that our life becomes more our interruptions. Well, the Eucharist, sometimes we put ourselves into that worship, and other times the worship kind of carries us. So I don't always want something new in the way of a kind of performance when I worship. The familiar that I've repeated and that I move into sometimes carries me, and that also is Eucharistic living. Okay, yeah.
In light of the goals, the standards, the high standards Paul has, is Eucharistic living being or doing? Is it passive or active?
Yes.
You're getting a lot of answers that the answer is yes, that it's being and doing. But go ahead. What if someone else had asked that or said that, Buzz, what would be?
My concern is that the focus on grace in the Lutheran family doesn't do a lot of motivating of people to live up to the standards.
Okay. And how could it? What just... give a description of a church that you thought lived Eucharistically in like regard to grace. What would be the marks of it? How would you either experience it or see it?
Not only receiving the gift or acknowledging the gifts, but using the gifts.
Okay.
For the greater community.
All right.
Beyond the church.
For instance, in generosity, the reason for the letter is to thank them for their gift, and they've supported Paul all the way along. So it is a generous congregation. It wasn't only a theory of Eucharistic living. This is the way they're living. Yeah. So, and some of the other things, I think, instead of theoretical living, it's a description of the way we live.
I think even the way maybe people in the congregation think about the Eucharist, the sacrament, is it just a receiving?
Mm-hmm.
Or you are the body of Christ, and you are blessed, and you go out into the world. Not just you receive the body of Christ, but you are sacrament to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a feel, I think, in joyful congregations of this sense of being sacrament to the world, whether they use those words or not.
Okay, thank you.
Someone earlier brought up transformation,
yeah,
which is one of the marks, I think, that's... there, and transformation seems to me to involve both being and doing, because one cannot really transform without some kind of inner experience and some outer grace or something. It has to be both.
Thank you. We got, yes.
Humility.
Humility, okay. Think more highly the business of the theology of the cross yesterday, Philippians 2, 5 to 11. Maybe especially 4. You should humbly reckon others better than yourselves. You must look to each other's interests, not merely to your own. And I think one of the other teaching staff this week made a really good point. Humility, humus, receptive. It's not groveling. It's not this kind of I'm no good. It's this receptiveness and the ability to relate to others because you know you might receive something from them instead of good. Good. That's Eucharistic living. We got about 20 minutes left. I'd like to shift and just give a try to this. If you've been here this week, you know these are not how-to sessions about your local congregation. We haven't spent much time on structure of congregations or kind of prescribing how to do these things. But I think that it's fine. I like Brad Holt's session on spirituality when he had some disciplines that helped keep the gift alive. I think that was a good way to put it. If it is by grace and it is the work of the Spirit that gives us a common unity and all the other things, how do we live this out? Maybe it's Buzz's question. What kind of disciplines would you see in a congregation that could help it more fill the marks of Eucharistic living? I'll give you the first one and then we'll do some others. How do you go about being more generous? I mean, is it environment or heredity? And we ask that about a lot of issues. I used to be able to get at the farmers in West Virginia when I took on the, sometimes that they weren't so generous, and I was their pastor. I said, you're tighter than the bark on a tree. They at least understood that, and we could talk, right? So one of the things is to find a way to communicate. But how would you become more generous? What? Ruth?
I think, well, I'm in a community. I live in a part of a congregation that's in a very affluent community. It's very wealthy. And one of the emphases, and they're very good stewards, and one of the emphases is giving out of one's abundance and in gratitude. And, you know, and really focusing on, again, the thanksgiving for what it is that we have. And that we don't give out of guilt, and we don't give out of obligation, though it is a discipline, but that we, that there is abundance.
Okay, so you make it a focus of, well, the teaching, the proclamation, the things that come from the church, the kind of, okay? To realize how tough it is, the reason I picked generosity first, to realize how tough it is, Seattle Times, October 4th, 1992, sometimes I stick something in the file to come back to. This is by Jennifer James. I ask an audience of 400 executives to vote recently on a question of the common good. I ask them if they would be willing to give up 2% of their power, privilege, position, status, and money for the common good. I offered, in exchange for their 2%, a stronger democracy, a better quality of life for many more Americans, less violence, healthier children, and a sense of fairness. They voted by means of a 10-key pad on each of their chairs. Their vote was unanimous. Unanimously no. 400. Unanimously no. I would like to ask you to take a minute and for you to vote. What would you be willing to give up for and for whom? Do you feel that you've earned your privileges, therefore are not required to share regardless of the cost to your country? Do you feel that you have had advantages or been fortunate in history and economics that you can afford to offer a small gesture to others, maybe especially children? I posed similar questions about equality for women and minorities to some high school students last month. Many were angry at the suggestion that they eliminate even their physical dominance of others, or to share. I wondered where young people could have gotten such attitudes. How would you vote on equality and nonviolence? How did you vote on my first question about the common good? The executives all turned me down. They made it clear that most would not give up one dime for the common good. They told me they had earned what they had. They did not think they were privileged. What happened to their communities was not important as long as they maintained the status quo. As to the high school, I found out where many of the high school students got their attitude. The parents applied pressure to get me fired from my next lecture in that district. They said I was unsuitable to lead a class. 1992, Seattle. So it is tough. I mean, it culturally, we, yeah, go ahead.
I had your question about how do we become more generous, uh-huh. And I think that sometimes we think about being generous as giving big amounts of our time. And, you know, I think personally, if you wanted to figure out how do I become more generous, do small acts of service for people mm-hmm. within your own communities, okay. within your own congregations, and teaching your children to do that. I mean, even on May Day, when this last year we made paper flowers, and my two-year-old daughter, and we went and took them to some neighbors. And they had, you know, to me that was a service to them to mm-hmm. lighten their life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how you can personally become more generous. Then once you get the hang of it, and you're having fun, and you see the joy that people have by doing small acts of okay. service, you can go out and you can give more of your time and bigger things. But
good.
You have to start small. You're not going to get big.
Thank you. Well said. Nikki.
You no? have to, I think, know that there's an element of risk-taking in generosity. If I give you my last dollar, it's gone, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. And if I agree to spend time with you because you're in pain, I'm open then to absorbing some of your pain, so I want to do both of those things.
Yeah.
But we have to recognize the risk-taking, and I think that's where community comes in.
Okay.
I give you my last dollar. Jen will give me 50 cents at least. Okay.
So they are connected, the community and the generosity? Yeah.
Forgive me a non-contemptive question about generosity. How generous are they about 10 o'clock deadline to get your lucky job?
My answer is mine's not there, okay. and I'll join you in if you're gonna risk, you need community. Yes.
Generosity.
Open generous.
Let me.
We don't do well with preaching the sense of all.
Yeah. Let me test one with you. My monk friend at St. Anselm's Abbey every year came with everything that he had. Maybe technically he didn't own anything, I don't know, but he had 3 pair of shoes and he had some records and books. And Father Abbott each year would say, Dunstan, you don't need 3 pair of shoes. 1 good pair and 1 work pair. Give this other, and would go down. Every year Father Abbott de-accumulates for you. That'll never fly. We will not appoint someone who will come into our closet and say, how about doing it on your own every year? How about a discipline of every week I will give something away? And would we move sometime to something that we really thought, ooh, no, this is important? Well, yeah. I gave away 10 Hummels once, one a month to a volunteer at Lutheran Social Services, because I've never seen anybody whose life was so transformed by a Hummel. I liked them, but not like this volunteer. I mean, she had so little in life, I would make her month with another Hummel. I now find out some of those were worth $700 a piece. If I had known that, I probably would have taken, I'm glad I didn't. I mean, I knew they were important things, but I had gotten them when my mom and dad died. And we had kids, they were a problem to us because we were always telling the kids, no, those are, you know. I once went in and Mike was touching the Hummels and I went, about 3 times he changed hands. But he didn't stop reaching for the Hummel. So anyway, what if that discipline of deaccumulating was tried, just so we tried it a little bit? I don't know. Yeah.
The concern that can come up in that situation is that we make sure we're deaccumulating stuff that not just, you know, if I get rid of that, I can replace it with something I'd rather have.
Right, right. That's always a concern. Yep. Yep. Sid Simon, who writes the books on values clarification and that, I heard him talk once. He has 4 shirts. He determined that's enough. More than that, he spends too much time picking out the shirt or having the drawers to put them in or the closet, so 4 is enough. Once in a while, he gets a new shirt. Great. But he gives one of the others away. What we do is we pare down sometimes. We did that when we moved. We got down to a small truck we borrowed to move. Then we lived in Minneapolis for 7 years, and we needed a 24-foot truck this time in 7 years instead of a pickup truck. So what we do is not find out what's enough and then continue to live with that. It's easy to accumulate. Thomas Merton said when he moved to a monastery, the reason he moved was he just wanted to turn away from, be a dissenter of, a world in which manufactured needs were then met by manufactured goods. Not a bad way to say it. Somebody who hasn't shared.
Some theologian said that we do not need more than 12 books on our shelves.
Uh-huh. That one. Now they're meddling. Shirts, books, it's like holding staff who can go by any mall but L.L. Bean and some of these hiking stores. Oh! Anything else? Okay. I want to read one thing for you that I really enjoy. Some of you have undoubtedly heard it. It was the inspiration for all of Dan Erlander's pointless people stories. What this really says is our problem with this Eucharistic living, especially generosity, community, and contentment goes way back to the beginning. It's the essence of early Genesis. This is by Ann Herbert, a speech teacher at Capital University, and I'm afraid that Buzz will say that she takes a little liberty with the early Hebrew text, but follow along. In the beginning, God didn't make just two people. God made a whole bunch of us. God wanted us to have a lot of fun, and God said you can't really have fun unless there's a whole gang of you. God put us in Eden, which was a combination garden, playground, and park, and God said, now have fun. That's the way it started. At first, we did have fun, just like God expected. We rolled down hills, waded in the streams, climbed on the trees, swung on the vines, ran in the meadows, frolicked in the woods, hid in the forest, and acted silly. And we laughed a lot. Then one day, there was this snake. And the snake said, you're not having real fun because you're not keeping score. We didn't know what score was. When the snake explained it, we still couldn't see any fun. But the snake said we should give an apple to the person who was the best at all the games, and we'd never know who was best unless we kept score. Then we could see the fun of it. Of course, we all thought we were the best. Boy, was it different after that. We yelled a lot. We had to make up new scoring rules for the games. Others, like frolicking, we stopped playing. Just too hard to score. By the time God found out what had happened, we were spending about 45 minutes a day actually playing, the rest of the time working out the scoring. And God was wroth about that. Very, very wroth. God said we couldn't use the garden anymore because we weren't having fun. We told him we were having lots of fun, that he was just narrow-minded because it wasn't exactly the kind of fun that God originally thought of. But God didn't listen. He wouldn't listen. In fact, he kicked us out of the garden. Said we couldn't come back until we stopped keeping score. To rub it in, God said it was to get our attention. God told us we were all going to die and then our scores wouldn't mean anything anyway. God was wrong. My cumulative all-game score is 16,548, and that means a lot to me. If I can raise it to 20,000 before I die, I'll know I've accomplished something. Even if I can't, my life now has great meaning because I've taught my children to score high, and one of them will reach 30,000. Really, it was life in the garden that didn't mean anything. Fun is great in its place, but without scoring, there's really no reason for it. God actually has a very superficial view of life. I'm certainly glad my children are being raised away from God's influence. We were very lucky, and we're all very grateful to the snake. So it goes way back, our problem, to in the beginning, like they say. Well, I want to thank you for our week together, for our time together, and the way we're closing is inspired by my mother. I now know that no matter what you say and how carefully you try to say it, that some people listen to this and instead of feeling empowered and grace, they feel, yeah, that's all okay for other people, but I'm really not good enough to do that. I now know that that's the case. Let me tell you a story. My mother never went past eighth grade, so she was always intimidated by the other wives that my dad worked in the headquarters of the old American Lutheran Church. The other wives had all been to school and knew more than my mother. I've heard this so many times. So she was always intimidating. Then she wasn't very good at articulating or writing or what have you. So one day, my wife Mary had a session in this room. My mother lived here with us in her old age, and I made sure that Mom came because Mary was talking about the gifts that people have, and she listed, oh, there are some people who bake bread for their neighbors. My mom did that every day of her life. There are people who are just good at listening or mending their grandchildren's things. That's my mom. Oh, The kids just loved her. She was just a wonderful woman. So Mary listed all these things, just, you know, interspersed them in the hour. So I saw my mom come out of Koinonia, and I said, "Mom, did you go to Mary's session?" "Yeah." "How did you like it?" "Oh, if only I could give talks like Mary." So all of you out there like that, here's my final benediction. And you might know, Gerhard Frost writes it. "When I remember that I'm a parent and think of God as a parent, what I recall is a special breakfast brought to me in bed. We awoke early to the sound of hurrying feet, and we wondered what they were up to, our 4 and 8 year olds, but soon it came. Breakfast in bed. It was an elaborate menu. Chilled burnt toast with peanut butter. Eggs fried, then chilled. Soggy cereal. They added the milk too soon. And tepid tea. It was one horrendous mix. When they stepped out for a moment to get something they'd forgotten, heaven forbid, my wife whispered, 'You're going to have to eat this, because I can't.' And I did. I didn't eat it as a gourmet. It was not gourmet cooking. I didn't even eat it as a hungry man. I wasn't one bit hungry. I ate it as a father. It was made for me. I was expected to. They had faith in me. I ate it because it was served on eager feet with starry eyes.